Hey guys, welcome to season 3, episode 3 of the Strong Dad Army podcast. Thanks again for the feedback on the past episodes and of course the new episodes of this season. Now last week I gave people the opportunity to win a couple of bags of coffee from Frontline Coffee Co. And I said all you had to do was head over to Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star rating and a nice little written review. Nobody's done it. What's going on? Now, you know, I know this isn't the biggest podcast in the world, but somebody's got to have a heart out there. Give me that little, just that little boost, that little rating, you know, pushes up the rankings that little bit, you know. I'd love to break even into the top couple of hundred podcasts in the health and fitness section. So do me a huge favor, guys. If you're listening right now, especially if you've got your laptop on or anything like that, or you're on your phone listening to it, head over to Apple Podcast now, leave us a 5-star rating and a nice little written review as well. And if anybody does this week, that prize will still be there for whoever I think has done the best one. Anyway, this week, while I've only managed to get this guy nailed down this week, and as soon as I recorded it, I thought this one is going out this week because it was a great episode. You know, there's not a single episode I've done that I haven't enjoyed doing, but this one was something completely different, special, if you like. You know, it's got a crazy, crazy story. And the guest on this episode is a guy called Mark Ormerod. Now, Mark was a serving Royal Marine. And in 2007, I think I'm right. I apologize, Mark, if I got that wrong, because I've literally only just come off talking and recording this, but my head is all over the place after some of the stories you came out with. But I'm pretty sure it was 2007. Mark suffered an absolutely catastrophic and traumatic bunch of injuries. I'm not going to tell you any more than that. If you want to know more about Mark, you simply just have to Google him, Mark Ormerod. You will find out a lot about what this guy's been through. But I don't want to tell you anymore because I want you to listen to this guy's unreal story about his time in the Marines, his horrific injuries, and his story about how it happened, his subsequent recovery and rehab, and the amazing work he does now. And then not to mention what he did afterwards with competing a couple of times in the Invictus Games. So no more chit-chat from me, guys. Just leave us that 5-star rating and written review over on Apple Podcasts if you would be so kind. Without further ado, here is this week's episode with Mark Ormerod. Enjoy, guys. Hey guys, welcome to the next episode of the Strong Dad Army podcast. And today my guest is none other than Royal Marines veteran and Invictus Games super amount of medal winner. I don't know how many medals he's won, but Mark Ormerod, welcome onto the show. Excuse me, Mark.
Thank you for inviting me. How are you doing, mate?
My pleasure. I'm doing fine, mate. I'm made up that you've managed to come on, mate. I really appreciate it. So how are you at the moment? Obviously, we're kind of, you know, we're well out of lockdown and all that kind of stuff, but there's some people panicking about whether we're going to be in lockdown again. But how's all that kind of stuff treated you and your family?
Do you know what? To be honest, mate, I just look at everything with common sense.
Yeah.
And I just continue to live my life, you know, within the rules, just using common sense, making sure that my family are looked after and they're happy and they're healthy and no one's going mad because we're locked in a, you know, effectively a prison cell 23 hours a day. So we're all doing really well. We've managed it all really well. We've resumed back to some sense of normality. Mm-hmm. And my crazy life hasn't really slowed down at all throughout the whole of lockdown.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Has that been just like busy with this kind of stuff, maybe podcasts and stuff? Because I'm assuming obviously with being locked down, you've not necessarily, or a few months back, you didn't necessarily get to sort of travel about and stuff. What have you been doing to sort of keep busy during the last few months?
So in my day job, I actually have what I call a real job. Yeah. And I work for a charity called RMA, the Royal Marines Charity. Mm-hmm. So I was furloughed for about 4 weeks in the beginning, but then straight off of that, so I've been kept busy with that, you know, working remotely. I host a podcast for those guys. We're doing a lot of stuff virtually. Then on top of that, I work as a speaker. That's really died a death, but I've also done some virtual events throughout lockdown. I have been editing my first book, finishing my second book, trying to organise publishing deals, recording audiobooks. I signed a contract for a movie.
Wow.
It's just been mad, mate. And I've got so many plates spinning, other projects I want to do, that I don't think I'm going to get a day off until about 2065.
So is that a good thing for you then? Are you one of these guys who just likes to keep busy, or is this just how things have happened, you know, and it's kind of like, shit, I've got a lot going on, or is that a good thing for you?
It's always been like this, mate, but I'm so lucky it sounds like, you know, super busy, and it is, but I've got so many cool people around me.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, these teams that I've created, you know, they take a massive load off of me. So that's how you're able to do it all, you know, because people are out there willing to help me and to open doors for me. So it's not like I'm doing everything 24/7.
Yeah.
But I do like to be busy.
Yeah, same here, to be honest, mate. I get bored very easily, you know. It's like, you know, I'm thinking to myself, when the kids finally get back to school and all that, I'm going to have all like this extra free time. But I know I'll fill that free time like that with nothing that's relaxing in the slightest, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
So, mate, so I tend to, you know, just sort of start it, you know, early days with people, you know, the guys I have on the podcast, is just, you know, maybe give us a bit of background about your childhood, mate. You know, what were you like as a kid? Were you good kid, bad kid? You know, do you do well in school? Were you sporty? What, you know, what were you like?
I was chubby. Mm-hmm. I was cheeky. And I did average at school.
Yeah.
So, not sporty at all.
No.
You know, I ran around every once in a while playing five-a-side with the lads, but, you know, never supported a football team, rugby team, wasn't into football, rugby, or any of those mainstream sports. I got more into sport, into martial arts when I was about 12.
Right.
But prior to that, it was just, you know, running around, getting into trouble and mischief with my friends, like all kids do. Until I discovered martial arts at about 12, I started with full contact kickboxing, then gravitated towards Muay Thai. And then when I was serving in the military, I boxed at heavyweight. But left school with, I would say they were average grades. I got 9 A to C's, so a couple of A's, a couple of B's, some C's, and then 1 D in my GCSEs. So did all right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah,
consider I'm not an academic, so, no. You know, I don't know how it happened, but I did all right.
Yeah, did better than you probably thought you would, maybe.
Better than the mock exams, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, cool. Nice. Yeah. Nice. So I know, like I said, you know, done a little bit of research on you today. And I know, like, when you joined the Marines, I think I'm right. Now, I've got this from Wikipedia, so I take everything with a pinch of salt there. However, you joined the Marines at quite a young age, is that right?
It is, yeah. Signed up at 16.
Wow.
Joined at 17.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I finished my training at 18.
Right. So how did this come about for you then? Like, were you saying, I mean, I know obviously it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be like sporty as such to join maybe the military or anything like that. But I mean, what sent you that way? Was it just sort of fate, or was it something you'd always thought about? Or was it just you happened to just walk past maybe? I know I've heard some stories about people just going past like a bit of a stand in a town centre, you know, whether recruiting or, you know, what pulled you in there, mate?
It's a mix of things, really, you know. So I was born in the 80s, raised in the 90s, big fan of Arnie, Stallone, Van Damme, and, you know, all these guys. So I grew up, that's what led me down the martial arts route, do you know what I mean? All these big fancy fly kicks and muscles and being the hero, you know, the tough guy but the gentleman. And like when I started martial arts, it kind of exasperated that, and I felt more at home in that kind of role, you know, physical, pushing myself, growing, getting stronger, fitter, faster, more able to look after myself, more able to look after other people, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of stuff. And where I grew up, all of the guys I went to school with were about 2 years older than me. So right. They all finished school before I did. And a lot of them joined the army and they went into the tank regiment that were based over in Germany at the time. Mm-hmm. And they'd come back on the weekends when I was at school and they would be out drinking. They all had new cars on finance and all this stuff. And I thought, I want a bit of that. These guys seem to be doing all right. I'm going to go in the military. And I live in a town in a city called Plymouth, which is a huge military city. You know, there's a lot of Royal Marines around here, huge naval bases.
Yeah.
But I didn't actually know who the Royal Marines were. And I just thought, if you're going to join the military and be a soldier, you join the army. So I went down to the career center, spoke to the recruiter. I was only 15 and a half at the time. And he gave me the paperwork. So I took it home to get my parents to sign it. And then my dad told me that I had an uncle who had actually served a full career, 22 years in the Royal Marines. And he had made his way from the rank of Marine, which is our equivalent of private, up to a captain by the time he left. Mm-hmm. And he only lived 20 miles up the road. So obviously I knew him. I just didn't know what his background was in his career and all that lot until I expressed an interest in it. So I went up and saw him and he told me about life in the Royal Marines and a little bit about his career and the things he'd gotten up to and how they were different to the army and the you know, different kind of career I could expect. So I went back to the career center on the Monday morning and spoke to the Royal Marine recruiter and he put in this this dusty old VHS cassette into the TV video combo machine. That's how old I am. And man, I just watched this video and I'm like, who the hell are these guys? You know, it was like what I watched in the movies, you know, with the Schwarzeneggers and Commando and Predator and, you know, Rambo. You know, these guys were jumping out of planes, you know, with ropes, you know, fast rope. And they were walking through the jungles. They were up to their necks in water patrolling. And then they were in the Arctic living in snow holes and skiing and, you know, speedboats flying along with guys in the back, weapons on their back, ready to go and take someone out on a beach assault. And I was like, this is what I want to do. These guys do it all. They jump out of planes from the sky. They're on the land. They're on the sea. They're in the Arctic, the desert, the jungle, the woodland. These guys go everywhere and do everything. I want a piece of that.
Yeah.
So I got that paperwork, took it home, got it signed, put it in, went back to school, waiting for a phone call or a letter from them while I was continuing to study for my GCSEs. And then finished the exams and got the letter saying, come and do a 3-day what they used to call it, a potential Royal Marines course at the Commando Training Centre in Nimston. And we'll see, firstly, if you're ready. And secondly, if this is actually what you want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, so you go out there for 3 days and it's just a beat down. Well, it used to be that they've stopped doing it now. They've advanced what they do and they do something different. But it used to be just 3 days of getting thrashed. You know, up at 5 a.m. and all day, gym sessions, assault courses, push-ups, runs, pull-ups, just to weed out the people that either aren't physically and mentally prepared mm-hmm. or, you know, on the other side of the fence to give us as potential candidates an opportunity to go, actually, this isn't for me, or no, this is perfect. This is what I expected. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was fortunate. I passed that first time. Came home, and then it was just a case of, I mean, this was prior to email and stuff, so I had to wait for a physical letter.
Yeah.
Just waiting for my training program to turn up. And they sent me a program saying, this is what you need to do, these runs on this time, this week, then you need to advance into boots, you need to be able to do this many pull-ups by this time. This is the date you're joining, February 2001.
Wow. And that was it?
That was all I cared about from that minute. As soon as I passed that 3-day course, I got back on the train. I only live 45 minutes from where we do our training anyway. And I just couldn't stop smiling all the way back. I'm like, that was hard, but I feel so good after those 3 days. And this sounds really nasty and a little bit sick, but it was nice watching people just drop off. You know, as the days went by, I think there was like 65 of us to start with.
Yeah.
And then, you know, blokes just dropping off hour after hour after hour because they either couldn't take or didn't want to do it. And then to be in that final handful of like 15 people mm-hmm. to go, we want you, go back, start training, come and join us and see if you can do the full, which at the time was 30 weeks, felt great. And then that's all I did. I was like, this is it. I'm not failing this. This in my gut, I'm like, this is who I am. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And nothing else matters, you know? So I just went at it.
Yeah. And that's, and like with you saying then about like watching these other guys drop off, it's like, I can completely get where you're coming from, because like, it's that extra boost for you, innit? Like when that happens, you see this one or two guys dropping out, then that has surely got to trigger something in your head thinking, I'm actually doing all right here, you know? And it's, you know, it's no wonder.
Do you know what it's like? Do you know what it's like? You know, in that movie Highlander,
yes,
right? Every time someone gets their head chopped off, the guy that chopped it off, like, gets their energy and everything. It was like that. Like, every time someone dropped off, I was like, and I'll steal their energy. Absolutely. And I'll keep going. No, it's brilliant.
Nice. So, so obviously that, like you say, you joined 2001, did you say, mate?
February 2001, yeah.
2001, nice. Now, I know obviously that there's a big chunk in between, but how long was it until you were, you sort of, how long did you, you know, officially serve for?
My entire career?
Yeah, yeah.
10 years.
10 years, wow.
Yeah, it was 10 years. Good time, though.
Yeah, I can only imagine, mate. I can only imagine. So, I know, obviously, we've got this story, which, you know, we'll come to, that took place in Afghanistan, I think. But, like, how often did you go away? You know, when was it your first sort of, you know, toured, if you like? How young were you then when you were first sent away? Actually on duty and as opposed to training, if you like.
So I signed up at 16, started training at 17, finished my training at 18, and by the time I turned 19, I was in Iraq, March 2003, on wow. Operation Telic 1, in that first wave that went over the Kuwait-Iraqi border,
yeah,
into Iraq to take the palace and the oil fields and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I finished my training in October 2001. So 4 weeks before that was when we watched 9/11 happen. So we knew, you know, as soon as we finished, we were going to be doing something. We just didn't know what at the time. So yeah, straight in there at 19.
Yeah. Well, actually, now you mentioned 9/11, and we just briefly before we started recording, we were talking about Martin Stapleton. And on the episode that he did with me on this, he was, I think he said that when on September the 11th, he was actually on a plane waiting to go on a training course. I think he said to America, actually, I might be wrong, but he was sat on the plane with the rest of, you know, rest of the Marines. And somebody just got on board and said, get off the plane. Something's happened. Go back and you'll be told more shortly. He said, and he knew something serious had happened, but he obviously didn't know it was as serious as it was. So it's just interesting to know what was going on around those times. So, so then we move on to, am I right in thinking 2007 when you were in Afghanistan? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I came back from Iraq. You go on a couple of exercises. You know, we sailed down to America. Like I said earlier, I did the boxing for a little bit.
Ah.
Took a bit of time out. Got back amongst it. And 2007, September 2007, Afghanistan came round for Operation Herrick 7.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So it was a six-monther. Well, it should have been.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, Christmas Eve that year, routine foot patrol, and I stood on and detonated an improvised explosive device. Yeah, not the best Christmas I've ever had.
I can only imagine, mate.
Yeah, it was pretty rough.
Right, so this was a IED, you say, yeah? And so if it's okay with you, maybe you could maybe just, you know, talk us through, you know, whatever you're happy to talk about there, mate, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, we were halfway through the tour.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our job was to go out there patrolling a certain area of Afghanistan, the company that I was working in, and to dominate the ground. You know, and take the fight to the enemy, look after the civilians that were there, provide some security and stability. So we were out all the time, you know, and we're always gathering intelligence. We know where minefields are. We're trained to identify pinch points and vulnerable locations where people are likely to dig in IEDs and that kind of stuff. And we've been out loads of times, you know, with no issues. We'd had loads of firefights with the enemy. You know, they didn't even come close to grazing us. You know, we just sent them packing every single time. And Christmas Eve came around and we were just going on another foot patrol, you know, another routine foot patrol, something we'd done 1,000 times before. The ironic thing about this patrol was the ones we'd done before, you know, we were given a mission, you know, like enemy location here, go disrupt it. There's a weapons cache here, go and destroy it or confiscate it. And we'd be out for 5, 6, 7 hours. We'd push 2, 3, 4 miles out. You know, that was the norm. Now, this patrol, all we were told to do was, because we didn't have a lot to do, and it was Christmas, and we were looking for a bit of downtime, we knew we had to get out on the ground to maintain the momentum that we built, because you're always being watched. And if you break that momentum for any reason, then to the enemy, it's like a vulnerable time where they look to attack.
Yeah,
so we didn't have a mission for this patrol. It was literally 2 sections, 8 men in each section, form up at the rear entrance of the camp. Leave the camp, 1 go north, 1 go south, patrol the immediate perimeter. We got told not to push any more than 300 meters out. So like I said before, we were going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 miles. We weren't even allowed to go more than 300 meters on this one.
Right.
Then when we get to the opposite side of camp, to the front entrance, just go through your drills, secure the location, close things down, get yourself in and finish up. So that's all it was. It was literally get out there, show these guys watching you that you're out there. I mean, they have no idea what, if we had an objective or not. It was just to show them that we're out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back in and we'll take a couple of days R&R. You can open up the mail on all the Christmas cards and letters and that kind of stuff you got. We'll have a little bit of a do, and then, you know, 2 days later, we'll get back amongst it and start taking the fight to the enemy again. So we had no cause for concern. You know, everyone was pretty chilled. Morale was pretty high. And we set off. You know, they opened the rear entrance of the camp. I was second in command of the section. I went north. Other guys went south. Went out on the patrol. Did all of those normal things that we usually do, what we call SOPs, standard operating procedures. So speaking to the locals, gathering intelligence, reporting back any suspicious signs of enemy activity and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And about 5 hours later, both of these sections were now on the opposite side of camp at the front entrance, ready to finish up for the day. Now, my section were located on a piece of high ground, like a ridge line, what we call the North Fort. It was one of our target indicators if we ever came under contact from the enemy. Now, beneath us, so when we're looking off this ridgeline down, we can see the camp that we're working at, of a place called Ford Operating Base Robinson. And then beneath that, further still, was the other group of men that we left with earlier in the day. So because we're so high up, we're in a tactically advantageous position for numerous reasons. You know, first of all, we can see everything around us for like 2 miles. So we've got the vantage point. Second of all, you know, it's a lot easier if you come into contact with the enemy to fight going down a hill than it is going up a hill. So we got tasked with giving those other guys who were in a vulnerable position what we call overwatch, which basically means the 8 men in my section will take up fire positions. We'll make sure that we've got all round defense and we'll cover them while they go back into camp. They'll then get behind the perimeter wall. They'll be safe. They'll cover us. We'll come down off the high feature, go into camp, job done. So, like I said, very basic, low level, standard kind of stuff. You know, nothing that we hadn't done a million times before.
Yeah.
So we get given the tasking, and the guy in charge, a friend of mine, Corporal Sean Halesby, he takes his half of the section and starts giving them fire positions. And then I take my half, and 12 o'clock my position, about 4 meters in front of me, was like a shallow bowl in the ground. Now, normally, if you're going to go farm on a patrol, the first thing you want to do is try and get behind some cover. You know, cover from view, cover from fire. And normally, you would get behind a tree, a building, a rock, a shrub. You know, anything that's going to give you some form of protection. But because we're so high up on this ridge line, that there wasn't any of that kind of stuff up there. So I thought if we jump in this little bowl, we're high anyway, so it's going to be hard to see us. But if we get on our bellies, it's going to be impossible. You know, no one's going to see anything. So given the terrain and the environment, that was the best form of protection that we had. So I jumped in. The lads all started taking up their positions. I stood back. I observed for a little while to make sure that everything was running smoothly. Did a couple of checks, a couple of last minute checks that I had to do to make sure that we were well defended in case there was a small arms attack. And then I started walking over towards the position that I'd selected for myself. And as I got there and I went to get onto my stomach, as I put my right knee on the floor, that was the minute that I knelt on and detonated an improvised explosive device.
Wow.
Yeah. I do remember it all. I will give you the shortened version, if that's right.
Absolutely, mate. Whatever's okay with you, mate.
So basically, I knelt on this device, it exploded. And if you can try and imagine what the terrain's like in Afghanistan, it's very sandy, very dirty, very dusty. So initially, this huge dust cloud's created, and I couldn't see anything. Now, there was no pain, and I didn't know what I'd actually done. And my instinct was that we had been attacked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought someone's fired a rocket, someone's fired a mortar, that's exploded somewhere nearby. So my fight and flight kicked in, my adrenaline spiked, and I started thinking, in all chaos, not being able to see anything, you know, when this dust cloud settles, ID where the enemy are and just start raining hell down on that position. Because if I can see where they are and I start shooting, then everyone else is going to see that I've found them and they're all going to start shooting. And we had a big HMG, big machine gun in camp, which could have just turned around and just ripped any enemy position to pieces. Now, where I was, I knew that the way I was facing, behind me, about 600 meters to my rear, down beneath me where the other section were, was a small rectangular forestry block. And like I said just now, if you're going to go firm when you're on a patrol, whether you're doing it in defense or offense, you want to take cover from view and cover from fire. So I thought if anyone's attacked us, it's going to be from that small rectangular forestry block, because everything else around it was just flat mud fields. There were no crops or anything. It was the only form of protection. So in my mind, you know, I'm saying, turn around, turn around, turn around. Find out where this came from. Start shooting. Get everyone to start shooting. Make some sort of tactical withdrawal and get everyone out there safely. And then we're going to figure out the best plan of action to take these guys out and make sure that no one gets hurt. Now, after 4 or 5 times maybe in my mind of saying, turn around, turn around, turn around, even though this dust cloud was still there and I couldn't see anything, I kind of knew that my body wasn't doing what I was telling it to do. I know how my body feels and I'm going to turn around quickly. And it just didn't seem to be doing that. Even though I couldn't see, I just knew, I felt it. And so I waited. You know, I thought, I'm going to have to wait until this dust cloud settles, have a look around, make some very quick decisions, figure the situation out, and then do whatever I've got to do. So that's what I did. I waited, you know, and it got to about chest height. And this is all in like split seconds, you know, and it's like, in my mind, everything's going at 150 mile an hour. You know, so many emotions and thoughts and procedures and drills and everything. But outside, everything was like in slow motion. So it gets to the chest height and I look around and I can't see anything. I can't see any of the lads. They've all been blasted out the area. So I carried on waiting. And then it got to ground level, hit the ground and disappeared. And then I looked down to where my legs should have been, and they had both been completely ripped off from the knees down. Like, just traumatically shredded, gone, nothing left. Which was a very surreal thing to look at. You know, I'm sat there looking at it, there's blood, claret, and all sorts of fluids pouring out my body. I mean, no pain. I've gone into this kind of shocked, surreal dream state, trying to comprehend what it was I was actually looking at. I think my brain was having a real difficult time trying to process it. And so, you know, I don't know if it's just the way I deal with things. I kind of try to distract myself. And again, this is seconds. I kind of look in, trying to process. And then I thought about my teammates again. So I snapped out of it instantly and I started looking around. And then saw the guy in charge again, you know, the look on his face and the shock and the lack of colour kind of made me think, you know, this is going on. This is serious, you know, because you kind of, when you're in that situation, when there's no pain and it doesn't feel real, you don't think it is, and you're trying to convince yourself because your brain doesn't know what it's looking at. So I guess kind of to give myself a bit of a kick up the ass and a final kind of signal that, you know, this is happening, Mark. You need to figure this out quick.
Mm-hmm.
I went to look back at my legs just to kind of see that it was real and I wasn't imagining things. And as I got to like the 3 o'clock position, when I was sweeping the floor with my eyes, I saw my arm just lying there in the sand. And from my bicep down to my wrist, the whole thing was just split open. It was just, it was like a dog chew. It was horrendous. There was no bone in it. The whole bone had been shattered. My hand was in good nick. And so I picked my hand up. I don't know why. And I kind of just looked at it and then dropped it in the sand and just let out this massive scream, you know, like through frustration. When all the realities and realisms came crashing down of what I had done. And I knew straight away that I've stood on an IED.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a high potential that I'm going to die now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the evacuation was pretty hectic. You know, we're trained in that situation, as bizarre as it sounds, not to go rushing in to help the casualty because there could be more devices around and you risk setting those off. So I knew that no one was going to get to me quickly. I knew that being so close to the camp was a blessing, and that someone, if anyone was going to get to me, they were going to do it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And all the lads just, you know, they kicked into their drills. They remained calm and composed, at least on the outside. Very, very professional, brave people. And they just did everything right. Everything right. And this medic got to me. He got scrambled out of the camp. He got to me, put tourniquets on my legs and my arm, put me on a stretcher. My right leg was still kind of attached by like a muscle tendon or something. And my foot was kind of in my boot. And that was it. If you imagine kind of being sideswept through your shins, mm-hmm. all that was really there was a foot and a boot and a strand of muscle or something. So he had to pick my foot up and put it on my stomach. They evacuated me out of the minefield, put me in a vehicle. Then as the vehicle was climbing up the incline to go back into the camp where a helicopter was due to come and meet me and evacuate me, me and a doctor fell out the back of the vehicle because it was quite a steep incline.
Shit, man.
And yeah, the driver, who was my sergeant major at the time, WO1 Bob Toomey, swung around, reached out to try and grab me to hold me in, and he ended up grabbing the femur bone that was poking out my right leg. And it didn't hurt because, you know, I had morphine at that point from the medic. So, you know, I didn't feel anything.
Yeah.
And he left the doctor. The doctor went tumbling back down the hill, but there was that other group that we'd left earlier. So that there were 8 armed men there to look after him. So he was fine.
Yeah.
And he got me to the helicopter landing site. And the last thing I remember is the Chinook landing and the sandstorm that it created from the propeller blades, the heat of the exhaust, and then the kind of mechanical sound the tailgate makes as it drops. And then I blacked out, which was the point I later found out that I died before they brought me back to life.
Wow. Mm. That's
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, yeah. But wow, mate, that's, you know, I'd read a bit, like I said, about what had happened, but yeah, that's hard hitting that, mate. So no doubt, obviously, you know, it's a very obvious statement, but no doubt the road to recovery was very, very long. I can only imagine. So were you treated over in Afghanistan or were you flown straight back to the UK? How did that work?
So obviously with a traumatic amputation like that, it's quite messy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my limbs were torn off. They weren't surgically amputated. So when the helicopter flew me back to the field hospital, they amputated both my legs above the knee and my right arm above the elbow in the field hospital. They cleaned out as much dirt and sand and debris as they could. They stabilized me. They flew me home Christmas morning where I got to Birmingham about 4 o'clock. And then I spent 3 days in a coma and then woke up in intensive care and spent the next 6 weeks in hospital. I was very lucky. I only had 3 further operations.
Wow.
Again, just to, I think they call it debridling. It's like going into your wounds with a wire brush just to scrape all the gunk and dirt out that may cause infections.
Of course.
And that was it. I did 6 weeks in hospital and then straight on to rehab at Headley Court to heal up a bit more because I had a lot of open wounds and burn marks all over me. And then eventually, give him my prosthetic legs.
Well, that's unbelievably quicker than I thought you were going to say. I honestly thought this was going to be like you were in hospital for 6 months, 12 months, maybe even longer. I don't know. That surprised me big time. So, so no doubt this took a lot of getting used to. Now, if you don't mind me asking, was it at this point did you have young children then? Because I know you are a dad, and you but did you have kids then, or did you have your children after this happened? And if you did have kids before then, was it a big thing for your children or for your partner or family? Obviously, not just your children and your partner.
So I had my daughter Kezia. She's 15 now. She was just under 3,
right?
When I got injured, and she doesn't know any different. She only knows me like this.
Yeah.
And my other two, Mason and Evelyn, came along after. They were born after, all the good old fashioned way. So that's all good. We're all happy down there.
Awesome.
But yeah. So I got 3 of them, 15, 8, and 7.
Nice. And that's it. Mm-hmm. Your dad, aren't you? That's all it is. Dad is dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, so if you're okay, mate, I'm going to skip on now because one thing that really stood out to me was the bit of info I picked up about the Invictus Games.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell you what, mate, I'm not even going to try and pretend I know anything about this. So if you don't mind, mate, you tell us a story. How did this come about? Whatever you want to tell us about this, mate, because I found it really interesting reading it. And I'd love you to tell the listeners about that, mate.
So after I was injured, it's so funny. People come up to you, right, when you lose a limb or something, and like when strangers meet you, the first thing they say is in 80% of the cases, "So when are you going to start training for the Paralympics?" And I'm like, I don't want to go into Paralympics. Why does everyone keep asking me about the Paralympics? I don't want to, like I said earlier, I did full contact kickboxing, Muay Thai, boxing. I didn't want to do like wheelchair tennis or, not that there's anything wrong with those sports. They just didn't appeal to me. I've never done track or field events in my life. I was into contact sports and combat sports, So I stayed away from sport. It was never a part of my recovery at all. And my main goal in the beginning was to leave my wheelchair behind, which I did on the 9th of June 2009. So that was my focus. I didn't care about sport or any of that. But in 2016, I was in my office at home and I started drafting out my goal list for the following year.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, Christmas Eve 2017 is going to be 10 years. Do something that I haven't done yet to celebrate that occasion and 10 years of life post-injury.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down and I think about it, and then I realized that I hadn't done any sport. So I thought I'd do sport. I'll figure something out in the sport world and I'll try that this year, leading up to that anniversary. Now the Invictus Games at that point, I think was 2 years old. So I had seen my friends and people that I went to schools, advancing their personal lives, and using the power of sport as a recovery tool. And I thought, I'll give that a shot. I don't know much about it. I know it's a thing that was dreamt up and ran by Prince Harry. I knew a lot of my friends got a lot out of it. you know, in various different forms, like I said, in their personal lives, professional lives, and whatever it is. So I'll do that. You know, I didn't really want to, excuse the pun, but dip my toe in the water with some club level, regional level thing. I just thought I'm going to dive straight in and go global.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a bit of research. I found some sports I thought would just be to go backwards and forwards on a concept two row machine for 4 minutes and 1 minute. Anyone do that? So I took that sport. Hands. Well, that's more cardio again. I'm sure it can't be. Right, I used to swim before. I was quite a good swimmer. It's probably not that different now, so I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just picked these sports what were mainly cardio-based where I could just hammer myself. And I honestly thought I'd just turn up and I'd be fitter than everyone, and that's enough. It wasn't at all. And I didn't realise even, you know, swimming, obviously, there's technique, there's strategy. Hand cycling, there's a lot to learn in that sport. But I thought, at least in rowing, all I'm doing is going backwards and forwards. So it is literally last man standing. Whoever's the... And eat, there's strategy. There's little micro adjustments you've got to make you better and improve your times and your splits and all that. And I just dived into it, mate, and just went crazy with the cardio.
Nice.
Yeah, and I did strength and conditioning. I was here where I am now in my garage doing cardio at 5 o'clock in the morning, 3 times a week.
Yeah.
Then I was doing S&C in the evenings. And then on the weekends, I had to travel all over the country to go to sports-specific training camps, like a rowing camp one weekend, then a swimming camp. And they were everywhere, mate. Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, Birmingham, Bristol, Bath, Plymouth. It was exhausting for like an entire year of doing that on top of the day job, on top of the family, on top of the multiple projects. But I was just like, I want to do this one. My whole vision was do this once, right? No one knows who you are. Just go in there, because I wasn't in any of those sporting cliques. Go in there as a complete unknown in the sport world,
mm-hmm.
thrash everybody, drop the mic and then walk out. Right. And that was it. And yeah, but it didn't pan out that way for me the first year. You know, I think I came back the first year with 2 silvers and 2 bronzes.
Mm-hmm.
But I got the...
Man, that's awesome still.
Yeah, it was good, but my goal was gold. You know, I wanted absolutely. Gold. And I got this really cool award. They pick one team and one individual from every country and every athlete to win an award. And I managed to win that award, which is cool.
Nice.
So although I didn't get the gold medals, I kind of thought, well, that's a nice, you know, I'm the only person in the team that's got that. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But when I came home, I couldn't let it lie.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no, I need to get the golds. And so I got a friend of mine to make me up a picture frame. And in the frame, in the middle, there's a giant yellow Invictus flag that loads of people have signed. And then there's 2 slots either side at the bottom with bronze medals, 2 with silver, and then there were 2 empty ones at the top. And I put it behind me, and behind the camera there is where my hand bike and my rower were.
Mm-hmm.
And I just applied again and spent the next year training just staring at those empty gold slots nice. That needed to be filled. And I was like, there's no way I'm not filling those slots the next year. Yeah. So I repeated the process. This time round, I learned the techniques and strategies, and I made scientific adjustments to my training, not just stupid caveman adjustments, you know, just go faster, just go harder. And had a better time of it, you know, came back with, I think that year, 4 golds, 2 bronzes and a silver.
Nice.
So it's kind of cool.
Awesome. That's very cool, that, mate. Very cool. Nice. So, it really interested me, that, mate. Yeah, so I'm glad you shared that with us. So now I know you've mentioned that your day job, if you like, is working for the charity. So what does that involve, mate, if you don't mind telling us a bit about that?
Oh, it's everything. I mean, my official title is Marketing and Communications Officer.
Okay.
So running social media campaigns, recording podcasts, face the camera things, updates that we do. You know, answering all the direct messages, replying to queries. That's my official role, but in that world, you know, you just do all sorts. So the other week I was giving presentations to the recruits mm-hmm. about certain aspects of the charity. Then maybe I'll be supporting fundraising events. Maybe I'll organise my own fundraising events. Mm-hmm. When I go and do personal speaking jobs to corporates and stuff like that, you know, generally I'll plug the charity there and they'll get a donation, hopefully strike up a relationship, a long-term one. So it's brilliant because it complements everything that I do and want to do in my life, and everything crosses over. Nice. So I'm not stuck in an office from 9 to 5, which is brilliant. You know, I go up to the Commando Training Center every Monday to, you know, make sure I meet and spend time with all the other members of staff at least once a week. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the time I'm on the road or at home, and I'm working remotely, doing all those different things, just trying to raise awareness and raise money for the charity.
Nice. So we're almost at the end now. So one thing I like to get all my guests to do on the podcast is to show us that no matter who you are, what you've achieved, what you've been through, all that kind of stuff, we all have embarrassing stories. We all have funny stories where we might have made a bit of a tit of ourselves. So, and being a Marine, mate, I know you're going to have some of these 100%. So fire away, mate. Give us an embarrassing story if you can think of one off the top of your head.
Okay. So here's one.
No holds barred, by the way.
Okay. So where I live in Plymouth, probably a year after I was injured, they on a big naval base here, they created a thing called Hasler Company, which started as a rehabilitation unit for Royal Marines, and then it evolved into a tri-service thing. So basically, if you get injured or become ill in the military, generally you get fixed in your unit and you go back to work. But if your injury or illness is of a nature where your career's over, you'll come down to Hasler Company, you'll rehabilitate, retrain, do all these courses, and then when you're ready, you leave.
Yeah.
So there was a point where all of my mates from Headley Court Rehab were down in Plymouth. And, you know, we're military guys, we go out eating and drinking and partying and all that kind of stuff. And we were out one, I think it was a Sunday, and the lads had been out since 12 o'clock. And then you've got to bear in mind, when I say lads, you've got to think of a mob of 40 strong blokes, right? Probably about 12 legs between 40 men, mm-hmm. right? They're in wheelchairs. They've got facial scarring. You know, a friend of mine had his whole nose taken off, and it temporarily had one made out of like masking tape, if you like. Mm-hmm. So it was honestly, if it was like, I imagine what the set of The Walking Dead looks like when we went out drinking.
Okay.
So it was crazy, man. And they've been out since 12 o'clock, right? And I couldn't make it out until about 7. So I thought they're going to be well-oiled by the time I get there.
Yeah.
And I'm not a good drinker anymore. So I thought I'll be all right. I wasn't. And we're in this nightclub later on. And I don't remember anything from about 10:30 at night. And I woke up at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's lucky because the nightclub I was in, a long time ago before I was injured, I used to work as a nightclub doorman. And so I knew all the lads there. The bloke who owns the company is a good friend of mine. So I was probably making a complete twat of myself, but you know, I didn't get a shoe in from any of the doorman. They actually helped me. And I woke up about 3 a.m. outside the club in a bus stop, right? So I lift my head up and I kind of open my eyes, and in front of me is my wife. She's got a little Peugeot 106. She's in the bus lane and the boot's open, right? I look to my right. One of my prosthetic legs is 10 yards down the road to the right.
Oh,
one of them was down to the left. And one of the lads had my prosthetic arm. I'd just taken all my prosthetics off and thrown them all over the street and fell asleep in a bus stop. So they put their hands under my armpits, right? Take me to the car, put me in the car. I wake up in the morning on the landing floor in my house, naked, in the fetal position, with a kebab all down the side of my face.
Nice.
And my wife was nice enough to take a picture of me. Nice. To take the piss out of me forevermore. But yeah, that was probably one of the last embarrassing thing that I did, you know, it was quite a while ago, but
no, it's a lot.
Yeah, it was pretty embarrassing, mate. It was pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, we've all, like I said, we've all done it. We've all, you know, nobody's perfect. We've all had a, we've all probably gone a bit too far at times, haven't we?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Right, cool, man. So pretty much at the end now, so can you let the people listening or maybe even watch on the YouTube video where they can find you on social media, where they can maybe look a bit more into the work you do with the charity, you know, wherever they can find you, mate, if you could, Twitter, Instagram, wherever it is.
So I'm all over it, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram,
yep.
LinkedIn, all that kind of stuff. All my handles are at markormrod.com, O-R-M-R-O-D.
Yep.
Website, www.markormrod.com. Pretty easy to find, really, online. And most of my social media is linked up to the charity anyway, so they can just follow the thread and it'll lead them to the charity there. So
nice. Awesome, man. I'll make sure I give everything a follow that I'm not already following.
Thank you.
All right, mate. Right, that's it, mate. We'll call it a day there. I massively appreciate it. I definitely know this episode's going to go down well, mate. It was a cracking episode. I really enjoyed that, mate. So thank you very much for your time again. And who knows, maybe we'll get to do it again in the future, mate. But best of luck with your podcast as well. Which, by the way, where can people check that one out? Your podcast. Where do we? What's the name of it? Where do we find it?
It's called the No Limits Podcast.
Okay.
And it's on all good platforms.
Yeah, cool. I'll check that out as soon as we finish recording, man.
Awesome.
Right. Cheers, Matt. Thanks for your time, mate.
All right, Dan. Thanks a lot, mate.
Thanks, mate.